Welcome to Sea Change, a podcast dedicated to telling the stories of amazing women who are out there disrupting the status quo and leaving the world changed for the better. I'm Annie Silas, CEO of Silas, a woman-owned and led financial services firm that is dedicated to creating more opportunity for women in our industry and in our community. I'm thrilled to introduce today's guest, senior CNBC media and tech correspondent Julia Boorstin. Julia is not only a preeminent journalist in her field and a fixture of any television on any trading floor around the world, but she is also the creator of the CNBC Disruptor 50, an annual list she oversees highlighting the private companies that are transforming the economy and challenging the establishment. She helped launch CNBC's Closing the Gap initiative to cover people and companies closing gender gaps and leads CNBC's coverage of studies on this topic. And as if that wasn't enough, she just published her first book, When Women Lead, What They Achieve, Why They Succeed, and How We Can Learn From Them. I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of the book, and I can tell you it's a must read. I'm grateful for her work and the example she has set for young women everywhere, and I'm honored to have her here on Sea Change with us today. So Julia, so excited to have you. It's such a thrill. Obviously, we want to talk about your new book, When Women Lead, which is so exciting. Coming out soon. Is there an exact release date?
October 11th. That's the big day. And then it'll be available everywhere, but pre-order it.
I love it. I had the great honor of getting to read the book already. And I can tell the listeners, it's absolutely fantastic. You have to pre-order it. You have to read it. It's actually a very quick read. It kind of flies by. I think the stories are amazing, very elegantly told. I think you managed to extract a lot of really, really important themes, just by letting the stories of these incredible women tell themselves. And that's what I love about it.
Thank you so much. Well, I was so excited to tell these women's stories. I mean, what's been amazing and what I feel so grateful about in my career is I've gotten to meet so many amazing people. And the women in particular have inspired me in so many ways. And when I'm just trudging through my day or dealing with a challenge or the frustration of a screaming kid when I'm trying to respond to an email, I think about these women who have inspired me. And the book started out as a project of really trying to share some of these stories. You know, there are a couple of stories of female leaders that really dominate pop culture, whether it's Sheryl Sandberg, you know, COO of Meta, now she's off to her next chapter, or whether it's, the most dominant image of a female leader, and that's Elizabeth Holmes. Like, if you talk about a female tech leader, if you ask people, like, female CEO in tech, come up with someone, like, who's the first person to come to mind? People often will say Elizabeth Holmes, but that is just not representative of the vast majority of female innovators who are out there right now. So it was really important to me to tell all these women's stories. And then as I dug deeper and deeper into these interviews and really enjoyed their interviews, I also thought to myself, I need to really understand the data about what it is that they're doing. I wanted to dig into academic studies and research, leadership books to understand this is what this woman is doing and this is why it's working. And here's what we can learn from this approach. And maybe this is not an approach that's characteristically associated with leadership or powerful management. But maybe these are characteristics that we should really be delving into right now.
Yeah. And I think what's so amazing about the book is that you've really kind of drawn from a really wide cross section, and the stories are all unique. They all bring a different perspective, but it comes together and there's actually some really powerful themes. I think that, you know, across different industries, different challenges, these women have faced a lot of the same things. And I think that that's kind of a cool thing that comes out of it.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different types of women in the book, you know, very, very young to launching companies and taking companies public in their 50s and 60s, you know, women of all ethnic and racial and cultural backgrounds, immigrants who have moved here from Ecuador and India, and also people who had all the privilege in the world and a number of women who went to Harvard Business School. But across all these women who each are different and lead in different ways, there are a couple of commonalities and a lot of lessons that I've taken and applied to my life and my job as a reporter for CNBC. And the one thing that has really stuck with me is that each of these women has been very intentional about pushing their own professional growth and development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know you were an athlete and there's some amazing data about athletics and leadership and also about women in athletics and this idea that there is a reason why athletes are more successful in business. And it has nothing to do with this idea of being competitive against another team. I was not an athlete, as you may remember. But this idea that there's a reason for that is because athletes are trained to do what they call after event reviews. I'm sure they don't call it that in sports, but that's what they call it in business. After event reviews, figure out how to learn from their mistakes and to drive their own progress. And each one of these women may have started out with certain innate talents or gifts, but really pushed herself to improve and become a better leader, come up with a better idea. And just this constant iteration and improvement is something that's really inspiring.
I love that. And I think that that's why it's so important to tell the stories, especially for so many young women out there who need to understand these things and who need to understand the challenges that you can face and how to overcome them. So let's take a step back. There's so much about the book to unpack. I have a laundry list of questions and I can't wait to dive into it. But let's talk about you for a second, because you are absolutely an example of an incredibly successful woman. I've spent the better part of my career on a trading floor being able to look up and see you a couple of times a day. A young woman covering a sector that has arguably been, you know, one of the most newsworthy, you know, sectors, tech, media, a lot to talk about there. Let's talk about your career journey and how did you end up in that seat, undergrad history major to, you know, preeminent tech media journalist?
Well, I am very grateful for all of that, all of those compliments. I really appreciate it. I feel like my career was in part due to luck, in large part due to luck. And we are all lucky in different ways. I feel so lucky that we graduated college in 2000. I was a history major. I'd never taken an econ class, but I was going to actually go to grad school and study international relations, but I had always done the newspaper. I was an editor on the newspaper at Princeton, and it was something I'd always just done. Journalism was just something I always did, whether it was writing classes or working on the newspaper or different magazines. And I figured I would just take a year before grad school and work at a magazine in New York and get to hang out with more of my college friends and sort of have a gap year before grad school. I applied to dozens of news publications, and the best job I got was as a reporter at Fortune magazine. So this is where I think my choice of taking a risk on an unfamiliar sector was important. And even though I didn't think I would care at all about business news, I didn't think it was interesting. I thought it was going to be a bore. I knew this was the best title. It was a reporter title as opposed to an assistant or fact-checking title. So I took the leap. And then I was very lucky to have a boss, a male boss who was a mentor to me. And I always think, you know, Andy Serwer, he's now editor-in-chief of Yahoo Finance. He has two daughters. And I feel like he treated me the way he would want another executive to treat his daughters. Mm-hmm. He encouraged me. He told me not to be scared. And he pushed me to be my best reporter and my best self. And so I really learned everything. I was hyper aware I didn't know going into this. And I think I actually overcompensated for the fact that I hadn't studied econ. And I was like, I'm not going to get caught not knowing what I'm talking about because I didn't take econ or statistics. So I studied up with some amazing journalists at Fortune, and I just overdid it in terms of learning how to read every SEC document. I read analyst notes like it was, the weekend read. And as a result, I did really well at Fortune because I made myself kind of a utility, able to write different kinds of stories. And that was an opportunity. And then Fortune and CNN were owned by the same company. And as a result, I was asked by CNN to come on and talk about a story I had written. I think I was 22 years old at the time. I thought it was hilarious to be on live television. And because I would thought the whole thing was so funny that, like, what am I doing on live TV? I didn't get nervous. Mm. So they had me come back and back. And eventually I became a contributor on CNN and CNN Headline News, and then eventually was hired full-time at CNBC.
That's amazing. I actually think it's interesting because one of the common themes of all the women that we've spoken to on this podcast who have achieved success, particularly in male-dominated areas, and I imagine a newsroom and covering business news is a male-dominated, or was maybe in 2000, and the thing they always say is that they just work harder than anyone else. And they know they're going to be taken seriously if they can lead by example and just show that they know their stuff. So it's interesting that that's something that you faced as well. Have you seen an evolution in the sort of newsroom space in terms of gender diversity and representation in your time there?
100%. I mean, when I was at Fortune magazine, and this was in 2000 to 2006, it was, you know, the higher ranks were totally dominated by men, and the younger people got more and more diverse. So at my entry level, it was about 50-50 men and women. And then the older reporters and writers, the more senior you were, the more likely you were to be a man. Now it's totally changed. Fortune, while I was in the final phases of writing the book, hired its first female editor-in-chief,
amazing.
Alison Chantal. I was so excited. She's been doing an amazing job, and the coverage has been awesome. So we've seen it change in the magazine industry. Of course, the magazine industry has been facing its own challenges just as an industry. But then it also, if you look at newsrooms, those are also seeing more women in leadership. I mean, look at MSNBC, now run by a woman. So we are seeing more changes, but I just think it's the business world in general has become more diverse. You are starting to see gender gaps close. Where we're not seeing gender gaps close is in the C-suite.
Right.
That's really where there hasn't been change. So there's that issue of the lack of change in the C-suite. And then also in the tech world, which I cover very closely, the lack of venture funding or the dearth of venture funding to female-led startups. That was another fact that really inspired me to write this book. I was meeting all these amazing women. On one hand, I was doing this Disruptor 50 list that I do, and I just loved interviewing these fascinating, you know, innovators who are coming up with crazy ideas to transform everything from education to energy to healthcare. And then I was looking at the statistics about what kind of venture funding goes to female founders. And last year, 2% of all venture funding went to female-led companies. And going back over the past decade, it's been about somewhere between 2 and 3% for the past decade. So those numbers are just crazy.
It is crazy. And I do think sometimes when something's in the headlines as improving, people forget how stark the statistics really are and how far we have to go. We talk a lot around here about how few women-owned asset managers there are, and, you know, what a small percentage of the assets globally women-owned managers manage. I think it's, you know, somewhere around 1%, which
crazy.
Is just insane.
It's crazy. It's
and
insane.
It's also a statistic.
Talk about that.
Yeah,
right?
It's a statistic that's been stagnant for 10 years. The percentage of assets that women manage has been stagnant for 10 years.
So I think we need to talk about these numbers. When I was getting my book copy edited and fact checked, there were a couple of statistics, percentages that they thought were typos.
Oh my God.
Because they were so low. And literally, I was talking about the percentage of venture funding that went to Black women in a certain year. And it was like 0.02% or 0.22% or something. They're like, no, this must be wrong. It's like, no, the numbers are just that bad. But I think it's, on one hand, it's very important to talk about the progress and to know that things are moving in the right direction, but also important, especially to talk to men about the fact that, like, these are the stats. I've had so many men say to me, it can't possibly be that the numbers are that bad. That sounds crazy. And like, no, they really are. What do you mean, you know, 85% of all venture funding went to teams that were only men? You know, there's another group that's like the co-ed teams that got more than the female-only teams. And people are like, what are you talking about? That's a crazy statistic. And I think that these are not typos, right? These are crazy facts that are just really influencing what happens with money and business. I mean, if you think about the power of venture capital or the power of asset managers, I mean, those people have a huge ripple effect across society.
Right. And I think one of the things you touched on there is this idea that there's sort of a pipeline problem, right? And that the problem of representation starts much, much sooner in the process than, you know, where you see it in a very visible way. Do you think that the women that you've profiled in your book are the exceptions?
Well, they're technically the exceptions.
Right.
So they're technically the exceptions because they're among the very few who've been able to grow and scale venture-backed companies. I also talked with some women who are running amazing nonprofits. I sort of take issue with the phrase pipeline problem because I feel like, especially in Silicon Valley, that phrase is used as an excuse. Like, oh, we just can't, we can't invest in more women. It's a pipeline problem. Oh, we can't hire engineers. There just aren't that many women who are graduating from college with an engineering degree. So I feel like the pipeline problem is like kind of a scapegoat. I think that, I mean, there's one woman I quote in the book who talks about the importance of, it's not about lowering your standards. It's just about changing what the standards are. For so long, venture capital firms would only hire someone who had already sold a successful startup or who had gone to Stanford with an engineering degree and then worked at Microsoft. And this idea that, sure, if you're going to be looking at those people, that's going to more likely be men. But if you just say, hey, what would actually make a good venture capital investor? Maybe we just need to like throw out the rule book and come up with some new criteria. It's not about lowering, but more like just changing the criteria.
I think this point is so important. It's this perceived risk bias that if the process is different, it's concessionary, which it doesn't need to be, right? That I think if you change some of these inherent structural infrastructure kind of historical ways we go about doing things that are exclusionary, maybe not by design at the beginning, but really are now, you can still have a positive result, right? But have a different approach.
Absolutely. And there are some interesting companies that I write about in the last chapter before the epilogue that are focused on hiring. And this idea that the resume is a really outdated way of hiring people. It shows what experiences someone has had financial access to in their youth, which says more about their family than it does about them. And it doesn't actually show what they're capable of. So there's some amazing tech-based tools that really strip the bias out of hiring and figure out what kinds of skills someone's going to be able to learn. Like, okay, they have these soft skills. They're going to be able to learn to be an amazing engineer or an amazing coder or an amazing bank teller, whatever these jobs are. And I write about some of the women, no surprise, who have founded these companies. One is called Pymetrics and is used by a bunch of, increasingly used by a bunch of Fortune 100 companies, because they understand that you're going to actually have more success with employees if you're hiring based on their potential and not based on their access that they've had historically.
Right. And this is where all the data and research you did going into the book really came into play, right? Sort of bearing out that the statistics showed that, you know, diversity was a positive thing for the bottom line, for the company, for the culture, for all of it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many studies. First, about how women face double standards. There's plenty of that. And that's frustrating. And there was actually one chapter that I was just dreading writing because I was so worried that the data was going to be depressing. And I was like, I'd read all these, you know, stacks of papers about how hard women have it. I was like, this is painful. I don't want to write this chapter. But as I started writing it, I saw women who have succeeded have these amazing tools for navigating these double standards and for putting on this armor where they don't let the step bother them. And some of these tools I've actually found really helpful in my life since I discovered that. But then also, if you look at the data, there's massive reason to be optimistic, because at the end of the day, all of the data shows that investing in diversity, whether you're a fund manager or a VC or putting together a board, those companies and those boards perform better. And having a homogenous group, whether it's investing or giving financial advice, all of these things show that there is advantage to having diversity. And it's not just because diverse groups bring in diverse perspectives, but also one of my favorite studies in the book shows that having someone who's from an outsider to your little group, they actually did the study with fraternities and sororities, which I thought was really funny, but having the presence of an outsider forces the people who are among the original group to reevaluate their ideas and to be more careful about their decision-making. So having a couple women on a board may make the men who've been sitting on that board for decades be a little bit more careful about how they make calls. And I think there's something really optimistic about that. So I started off nervous that the data was so depressing, and I ended up super optimistic that if people care about making money and if people can just pay attention to the data, at the end of the day, there will be a drive towards, you know, closing these gender inequity gaps.
I love that. And just to go back to something that you were just talking about that I think is so important, in the book you talk, and I think it's a really powerful part of the book, you talk about your experience of going on maternity leave for the first time, what you faced, what you feared, and how when you came back, you found that being a mother made you better at your job, that the skills, the way you felt about things, your thought processes, like almost the way you looked at the world had been altered to the benefit of both your career and, you know, being a mom and being at home. I think that that's a really, really interesting idea. And I wanted to kind of tie it into the idea in the book that so many of the characteristics that women have that are traditionally perceived as weaknesses are actually strengths. And I think it sounded like something that, you know, became apparent to you on this journey of talking to all these women. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you summed it up so well. I think it became apparent to me in kind of my journey as a working mom and also in talking to all these women, because I'm a very careful person. I'm risk averse. And, you know, my way of succeeding at Fortune magazine was just working the hardest and just figuring if I just work the hardest, not take any risks, just play it safe, I was going to succeed. And ultimately it was fine. And I was a cog in a wheel and I did great. And I did some really fun stories, but I didn't really take any risks. And what I saw when I went on maternity leave is that I love my job. I was excited to come back to it, but I wanted to make the most of that time I was away from my kids. And if I was going to be away from my kids for however many hours a day, I was going to make sure that I tried the hardest things. And I didn't hold back. What was I holding back for? What are you going to hold back for anymore? And by the way, if I failed, if I got rejected, it didn't matter because I got to go home and see the smile of my baby and deal with the crying and all the other stuff. But also I knew that the work was not the only thing.
Right.
So there was something very liberating to me about it. Both it was like a kick in the pants, like get out there and take the swings. And when I came back from maternity leave, I pitched this thing, the Disruptor 50 list, which I've done for the past decade, which has been my baby and one of my favorite things that I do. I get to talk to these amazing, innovative CEOs, but it was because I was like, okay, I really want to make the most of my time at work. So that inspired me. And then also just the efficiency. Like I don't piddle around wasting time. I know that my time away from my kids has to be efficient. And I think that's been really helpful as well. And then also just knowing that I'm going to be rejected when I pitch ideas sometimes, and it's okay. And it's better to take those swings. And I think I'm just less intimidated by the whole process because I know that it's not the be all and end all. It's not the only thing that matters.
Right. And I love this idea that there's been this evolution for working women that instead of trying to pretend that this other part of you doesn't exist, you can sort of own it and say, you know, I want to do this quickly and efficiently because I want to be home. And that's okay. Yeah. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that I have to say is with all of the advantages of being a mom, there's no doubt that working moms have been hit incredibly hard. There's been so much data about the motherhood tax, the motherhood penalty, how women are dropping out of promotion, you know, not getting promotions because they're being held back because of the time they took off from maternity leave. Reshma Soojani has written amazing books that touch on this a lot. So we have to know that of course women have been hit hardest in terms of work during the pandemic, but I feel very privileged that I've had like an amazing childcare situation, parents who live nearby, and a husband who has been a great partner to me in all of this. So I think there's like that balance of acknowledging how hard it's been for working moms, but then also like if you can figure out ways to channel some of that, there are great advantages as well.
Yeah, I love that. So going back to the book again, talk to me about how you decided which stories to include, who you spoke to. Were people receptive to telling their story? Did you find that you had to dig really deep, or were they willing to share kind of the bumps in the road along the way?
So I started off starting to talk to people in January of 2019. So I realized I wanted to write this book, it was like, it's about innovators, it's about women and leadership and equity gaps and all this data. I was like, I knew I had to write this book. So I started talking to people, and I start off by going to VCs and saying, hey, who are some of the amazing women you invested in? I'd love to hear like why you invested in them. And then can you connect me to them? So I started having meetings. I went to San Francisco and like had some meetings and then just started having these conversations. Then when the pandemic hit, everything shifted to Zoom. And it actually opened up. I was really worried about that. I was planning on traveling around the country and spending time in people's offices and getting to know them in person. And I was really worried that Zoom would prevent me from really having that intimacy of understanding who someone really is. But I think it turned out to be totally different. First, it enabled me to talk to so many more people because I was just on Zoom with them at whatever weird hour they were available. And I didn't have to be schlepping to everyone's office. They just like were in their living room talking to me. And I think it meant I could access many more people, and people were really open and vulnerable. Everyone was, you know, between, you know, March and even, you know, that first year of the pandemic, a lot of people were spending a lot more time at home, if not entirely at home. And especially that first summer from like March until September, I feel like there was a sense of people sort of retreating from their everyday lives and taking stock, thinking about what is it that really matters to me? Why am I running this business? What are my leadership strengths and weaknesses? And so I feel like because all these leaders had a minute to stop and think about the way they approach the world, it was this magical time to talk to them about their leadership. I remember there was one CEO I talked to on Zoom for about an hour. And then she says, you know what, I have to take my dog for a walk. Come with me. So I got on her phone, you know, she put me in her headset, and I talked to her and was recording our interview as she was walking her dog. And she was pouring her heart out to me. And then about a year later, I was fact checking some stuff with her. And she said, oh my God, I can't believe I told you that story. I was so vulnerable in those early days of the pandemic. I didn't even think, you know, I wasn't holding back. And I was like, do you mind? And she said, no, I'm glad that I just was able to talk about that stuff. So I think that there was a sense that people were more free in terms of the way they were, you know, letting me into their lives and homes, but also just thinking about things differently.
Yeah, I like that. I love that, because I think that, sometimes I think when women achieve a certain level of success, they're also expected to, you know, have made it look easy. And to be able to uncover, you know, the emotional ups and downs that go with it, the challenges people face, I know you must have faced them in your own career, getting to where you are. I think that's a really important part of the story.
It's never easy for anyone. It's never easy. And I kind of feel like maybe it's the pandemic, maybe it's just the age that we live in, but people are past trying to pretend.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, because it just seems like such a waste of time to put on that show.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. It's exhausting. Yeah. So once you were able to step back, you had this sort of entire data set of interviews, conversations, all the research you've done, all the numbers. What was surprising to you? Did it tell the story you thought it was going to tell, or were there themes that you hadn't expected?
I went down rabbit holes. So I would start talking to one person, and then a female CEO would be like, oh my God, you have to talk to these two other women. I met them at a conference last year. They're amazing. You have to talk to them. So very much this idea of people recommending other people that I talk to very generously, defying that myth that women do not help each other. Women, I have seen, massively help each other. And so I just talked to all of these people, many of whom, unfortunately, I could not fit into the book, but I was trying to organize the ideas. So I got these giant, you know, those giant, like 4 foot high post-it notes. So I would put up these giant 4 foot high post-it notes, and I would just mark down who fit into different categories.
Okay.
Because, you know, not everyone leads in the same way. And I saw that very evidently. And some women were leading more by doing this, what they call like gender judo, of being like hyper feminine, but also hyper aggressive, and balancing these things to not confuse the investors or whatever it was, but taking kind of a strategic approach to that. Other women were leading with empathy. And I tried to sort of group the women who had similar characteristics. And I mean, I think I was blown away by the fact that you can be successful by leading in so many different ways, including leading as an introvert. We never think about introverts as being successful leaders, but there were a number of women in the book who had figured out how to use the fact that they hate public speaking to their advantage. One of them would be listening in such a way that she could always like use the listening and the long pauses to figure out what her counterparty's negotiations always wanted. Another organized meetings to make sure that everyone would get a chance to vote before the loudest voice in the room steamrolled the conversation. So these ideas of taking these things that do not seem like superpowers and turning them into these like secret superpowers. So just the diversity of the leadership really impressed me, but also that these are characteristics that we all either have or can improve upon. The empathy thing, as the idea that empathy is important for understanding your customers and understanding your employees, but also understanding the complexity of a problem and doing this sort of contextual big picture thinking. Almost every woman in the book, I would leave the conversation thinking she's not just trying to have short-term success. She is looking for a big picture change. She's not trying for like the quarterly results. She's looking 5-10 years down the road and thinking about how can I create a new model that maybe works better for women, or a new model that's going to help the environment, and not just, you know, it's like not the Band-Aid, but the big picture health of an industry and a business.
Did this project make you hopeful for gender equality, for equal representation, yeah, for closing that sort of C-suite gap?
It made me hopeful because study after study after study showed that gender diversity is better for business. Racial diversity is better for business. And I just thought there are so many people out there who care about making money. And once they fully understand this data, then things will change. I also am optimistic because of this data about about how many people it takes for things to really change. And there's this idea of like a tipping point around 30%. So like when you have 30% of a board be a women or minority group, that's when things can really change. There's this idea of a critical mass. And in so many boardrooms and so many C-suites, women do not have a critical mass. But I think more and more we're starting to see, yes, there are companies which have 50-50 C-suites or 50-50 boards, but that is really unusual. But I think once we see women inch up to that critical mass of roughly 30% in representation in C-suites and boardrooms, I really believe that things can change quickly after that. We're not there yet, but I'm so optimistic just because financially it makes more sense.
Yeah, and it feels like a moment in time. I think it feels like a moment when people are doing a lot more of kind of putting their money where their mouth is around kind of the initiatives that are going to drive this change, that are going to get more funding to female entrepreneurs, things like this book that are highlighting it. To me, it feels different this time.
I hope so. It does. But I also think that like, when you think about the characteristics of female entrepreneurs in general, they have an ability to do more with less. They raise less money. They're more likely to get to profitability faster. There are a number of studies I include in the book showing women generating higher returns with less upfront investment. At times like this, with economic uncertainty, whether it's inflation or risk of recession or other COVID waves or all these things, in these tough times, that's when that scrappiness and that ability to do more with less, not the ability to get out there and raise gazillions of hundreds of millions of dollars, that scrappiness is really, really valuable right now. Because by the way, venture investment has declined. So there are some companies that won't survive because they didn't have enough in the bank. But I do think that the female tendency for scrappiness will be very, very helpful right now. And yeah, another reason to be helpful.
I couldn't agree more. I think we talk about this all the time, but when the market gets volatile, that's when you really need a lot more perspective in the room, not when you're facing the same old issues. Let me ask you this. When you kind of take a step back and apply that to the tech and media space that you know so well and have covered for so long, and that has been traditionally male dominated by very, very public, high profile, you know, successful male leaders in the space, are you seeing a similar evolution there? Do you think that space is starting to have more female voices, more female representation?
Well, there definitely are more female voices, but I think the process is really slow. And I think that the media attention is largely on the big stars, right? Whether it's like, and star might be the wrong term, but like the most high profile people. So whether it's like a Mark Zuckerberg, or by the way, Adam Neumann, who had a very public fall, a lot of women have told me they're very frustrated that he just raised $350 million for his new company. I mean, he was investigated for fraud. This is someone who did not go out with, on top. He went out with the wrong kind of bang. And a lot of people say that the fact that he could go out and raise 300 plus million this, you know, at this moment when venture funding has been tighter for an idea that's pre-revenue, that is a sign that things are not changing. But I think that we just, you know, like, society gets stuck on these stereotypes and archetypes, and the image of a leader is still a man in a suit or a guy in a hoodie. And there just aren't that many role models out there. There aren't that many examples. And I do think the media was particularly hard on female founders of startups during a particular year. And I think we just need more of these images out there. I mean, that's why I wanted to tell these stories, because some of them you've heard and some of them you've never heard of these women before. And they're amazing. And they look and sound nothing like the male leaders.
Yeah, actually, that's another thing I should mention about what's so much fun about reading the book. You do highlight a lot of companies that I didn't know about that were out there that are huge and successful and have really interesting leadership that are really important for people to be aware of.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really fun to hear some of these stories that were new. And then hopefully with the stories or the companies that you may have heard of, that the story of the founder and her approach was surprising.
No, it's absolutely fantastic. So with that, we usually like to end our podcast with just asking our guest a few fun questions. So if you're up for it, we have a couple of fun questions for you. So first, we wanted to know, what has been the most surprising interview you've ever done for the book or elsewhere? And it can be surprising in a good way or a bad way.
Well, I'll say Paris Hilton.
I love it.
We were just talking about that. And Paris Hilton is the self-professed queen of the metaverse.
Love it.
And it was just really interesting talking to her in her amazing house. with her crazy wardrobe that was all hanging up because she was about to pack to go on her DJ tour, about how she had learned so much from being a reality TV star and how she was taking that into this new dimension. So it was very surprising on many counts.
I love that. Second question, what is your absolute dream interview? The person can be alive, dead, past, present.
You know, I've never interviewed Jeff Bezos. I've interviewed a ton of crazy CEOs. I've interviewed Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. I've never interviewed Jeff Bezos. And I think he'd probably be too guarded to give a really open interview, but I'd be really curious.
Well, Julia, with that, I won't take up any more of your time, but thank you for being on. Thank you for sharing the story. Thank you for the book, which is absolutely amazing. I think it's a hugely important piece of work. Everybody should go out and get it. I would say you don't need a background in business or finance to appreciate the book and enjoy it. It profiles some amazing women. It's incredibly inspiring. I found it hopeful. And I'm excited to see what comes next from you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yes, this is a book for anyone who exists in the world as we have it now, whether you're a leader or a cog in any kind of wheel. This is designed to give you a little bit of insight into how the world works and how you might be able to fare better in it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So October 11th, pre-order it now. Don't wait. It's amazing.